And actually, Rutherford postulated that the charge of a nucleus was half the atomic weight. This was wrong, okay, because in that year, van den Broek, a chemist, I think, postulated that it's a completely independent object. It's nothing to do with the mass, but the charge is a separate, what we would call today, a quantum number. Okay, so that's Z. And Z, this quantum number Z, actually corresponds precisely to the position of a element in the periodic table. Okay, and Z was inferred from X-ray spectroscopy that used quantum mechanics that we already knew. Okay, and as I said, people realized that the nuclei are not elementary because the nucleus of hydrogen contained a single proton, and the masses of the heavier nuclei suggested that there's something else, the neutron. Okay, and although it was found much later, people already thought about nuclei in terms of protons and neutrons being put together. Okay, and of course there was this, people had already seen isotopes, and the differences in between isotopes was ascribed to differences in the number of nuclei, neutrons and so on. Okay, so there was no question that this was not a that this was elementary. I mean, it was not. Okay, so Heisenberg, so a lot of people started to try to understand what's going on, and Heisenberg introduced the notion of isotopic spin. Okay, so he says, Heisenberg writes that the proton and the neutron are so nearly equal in mass, they must really be the same particle. There must be different quantum states of the same particle. Okay. And he introduces this isotopic spin. He says, if it is one value, then the quantum state that you see is the proton. If it's another value, then the quantum state that you see is the neutron. Okay. So he said that the charge of the proton of the nucleon is half plus this spin factor. Then Newcomb proposed that the interactions between nucleons should be due to some other particle which is being exchanged. People already knew quantum electrodynamics, so this was an extension of those ideas. And this particle was identified in 1947, and it had three charge states. And I don't know who, but somebody by that time had already written down that the charge of this object was just I3, and this was a triplet, isospin triplet of particles. Okay, Pais at that point introduced the notion of a baryon number, which was 1 for the nucleon and 0 for the meson. So he distinguished between mesons and baryons in today's language through this new quantum number B, and wrote this formula, unified these formula in this way. The charge is B by 2 plus I3. And of course, these formula could also be applied to nuclei. Okay, that Heisenberg had already. Okay, and of course there was the discovery of neutrinos, and then discovery of the muon, and a whole new story began from there, and Amol will talk more about it. Okay, so at the beginning of the 1950s there was a very nice simple classification of elements. Okay, so there were three kinds of particles. All of them were involved in the electromagnetic interactions. They were the nucleon, two states of the same particle, the pion, three states of the same particle, the electron, the muon, at least a neutrino, okay, and the photon. So all of them were involved in electromagnetic interactions, and these two, the ones in the brown boxes, were involved in the weak interactions, and the particles which I've colored in green, they have strong interactions, and people wanted to understand more of the strong interactions by studying the nucleus. Okay, and that's why nuclear physics became important as a piece of physics. Okay, but very soon, early 1940s, already there was a problem of proliferation. Okay, people discovered many more strongly interacting particles. Okay, five particles which were called V initially, a tau which was later multiplied into a tau and a theta, okay. And it was not clear whether things were really remaining so simple or whether something more should be done with it, okay. This was the big problem of the time. Everybody whose names you will recognize was working on this problem, okay. So there were various suggestions about how to deal with this, and Abraham Pais suggested that, you know, why have isospin only? You should have also an isoorbital angular momentum. Okay, so maybe these particles have the same isospin, but they have different isoorbital momentum. Okay, as good a suggestion as anything. Okay, and if they have orbital and isoangular momentum, then maybe they have isoparity, and so on. Okay, so this is the situation in 1952 when this young man wrote his first paper. Okay, so remember, Gell-Mann was born in 29, so that means he was 23 years old, younger when all this was going on. Okay, he took that other person, of course, everyone recognizes. So he took Pais' idea and suggested that the total Z component of isospin, orbital plus angular, should remain conserved, okay, no matter what happens. Okay. Then he said, now if I have a new quantum number called isospin, then the Pauli principle that governs collections of particles, okay, should tell us that fermions are antisymmetric under all their coordinates, okay, which means spatial, spin, and isospin, and bosons are symmetric. Okay, so collections of bosons are symmetric. So he used this idea, and he wrote down which reactions, particle reactions, are allowed, which particle reactions are not allowed. Okay, a very short three-paragraph paper. Okay, his first paper, first publication. I think this is later. Okay, so nice little thing. Then a few years later, Gell-Mann and Pais together wrote a paper which made a few observations and resolved a problem that Amol will talk in more detail about. But I just want to tell you what ideas they used. Okay, they argued that the particle theta and its antiparticle theta bar, they do not mix under strong interactions. And the reason he said this is because when you try to produce a theta, you find that you have to collide hadrons together to produce them, but you always produce a theta and a theta bar together. They always come associated together. So this was called associative production. Okay, so they must be considered to be distinct under charge conjugation. Okay, the charge conjugation is something that for a charge particle would take it to its opposite charge, but for any particle it would take it to its antiparticle. Okay, so theta and theta bar cannot be the same because they are always produced in pairs. So this production process must be distinct under charge conjugation. Okay, but under weak interactions they can mix because one can go into another. Okay, and therefore the eigenstates of charge conjugation cannot be theta and theta bar, but some mixture of them. Okay, now this nice and complicated argument teased out nicely. Okay, but they already had the idea of associated production and something happening with associated production, which could easily have been written down at that point as being another conserved quantum number. It wasn't written down in this paper. Okay, but in 1956, Gell-Mann proposed a formula for charge, which was exactly this. He said that there is a formula which Pais has written down, charge equals B by 2 plus I3, and you have to add to it a certain term S by 2. Okay, so here's a new quantum number S which particles have, okay, and S equal to 0 for what he called ordinary particles, which are the particles which were known before 1950, that is the nucleon and pion. Okay, And for anything else, S is not equal to 0. Okay, so they are to be called strange particles. They are particles such as the hyperons and K particles. Okay, basically what I was showing in an earlier slide as V's and theta, tau. Okay, so these are to be called strange particles. S is to be called strangeness. Okay, and he also noted that Z, I3 and B change sign when you take a particle to its antiparticle. So also S must change sign when you take a particle to its antiparticle. Okay, and he had a footnote there. His footnote said, it should be emphasized that the conservation of strangeness is nothing but the conservation of IZ restated in a more convenient form. And this is absolutely wrong. Okay, because S is a completely different quantum number. Okay, so you can see that, you know, he is inventing this new thing, but it's, it comes mixed up, right? So it's right when you write down that first thing, it's not totally clear to him. It's also interesting that he refers back to an unpublished preprint of August 1953 by himself and the proceedings of a Glasgow conference with Pais. Okay, and that's 1954. So that idea was already available when they wrote this paper, but it was not used. Okay. So, you know, it's a new idea, it's not clear, it's compartmentalized, it's not properly utilized, and so on. Okay. He also interestingly attributes the term associated production to M.G. Kimmel. So that is an interesting sidelight, because that means that although you don't find mention of TIFR experiments in the histories of this time, okay, they were very much there, they were involved. Okay. And if you look carefully at the papers, their contributions are acknowledged. Yeah. 54, he hadn't come to TIFR, that's correct. But nevertheless, it is true, if you look at the record of that time, soon after, you find these papers are being referred to. Right, thank you. Okay. Now, there was a development in Japan. Japan, of course, was already a bit of a powerhouse in particle physics since Yukawa's time. Okay. And out of Japan came a paper written by Nishijima, okay, which had exactly the same formula as Gell-Mann's, except that Nishijima used something called eta charge, where Gell-Mann had called what Gell-Mann had called strangeness. Okay. And he reached basically the same results. Okay. He reached a result which Gell-Mann had also stated, that strong interactions are independent of charge and conserve strangeness, weak interactions change strangeness. Okay, so this is stated by both of these people, and he suggests a resolution of the tau theta puzzle which is equivalent to the Gell-Mann-Pais paper. Okay, all this in one paper, published in 1955, received in February, published in March. Okay, now when I was a first year student, you know, just a couple of years back, that is, okay, I used to hear stories that, you know, in those days people used to not only put the month in their paper, they would also write the date, and some people would even write the time. Okay, so you can see why, because of all these, it was a hot topic, lots of people were writing. Now, today, you can look back and say, this paper is important, that paper is important. Okay, so you look at only a few, but at that time it wouldn't have been clear. Anyway, so in this paper he thanks Abraham Pais for, Nishijima thanks Pais for giving him a copy of the proceedings of the Glasgow conference. Okay, so if you look at the timings, it looks like he must have already had this idea. He got this paper and he realized he better write it fast, otherwise he'll lose credit for it. Okay, so he did write it fast and he gets some part of the credit for inventing strangeness. Okay, as soon as this was out in being talked about in Japan, Sakata proposed that all particles be made out of a doublet of baryons, the nucleon, the neutron and the proton, and a singlet, which is the lambda z. Okay. And in this kind of a model, he says that the pion should be antinucleon nucleon, the theta should be nucleon anti lambda, the antiparticle of theta should be the antinucleon lambda. Okay, and then of course he also said that the sigma baryon should be this baryon anti baryon baryon. Okay, and similarly the xi, the cascade should be a n is a nucleon. The nucleon is a doublet, right? Neutron proton is an isodoublet. Yes, of course. Of course. Okay, so there are strong interactions involved. Binding energies can be large. Okay. So, right. So, this is Nishijima's scheme, and his paper, which is actually a report of a talk, is no longer than this. It's basically like 4 or 5 paragraphs and a table. Okay, table which contains exactly this. Okay. So the idea was exactly this, that everything, so now when I look back, when I talk to people who were involved here, they say that yeah, this is the notion of a bootstrap. There was this notion that things, hadrons are so strongly interacting that there's nothing elementary. Okay, every hadron is made out of everything else. Okay, and somehow within that, Sakata made such a model. Okay, now this model turns out to be similar. Okay, because the next thing that happens is a paper in 1962 in Physical Review, okay, which by Gell-Mann, in which the eightfold way is written down. Okay, so what Gell-Mann does is he takes Sakata's model very, very seriously. Okay, he looks at the symmetries of currents, that of hadronic currents, which would be generated if you take these mesons seriously, if you take the Sakata model seriously and forgot all about the mass differences between the elementary baryons, the nucleon and the lambda. He looks at it and he says that this should be some symmetry group called SU3, which no one knew about in those days. Okay, in fact, there's a story, someone reminded me of this story yesterday, that Gell-Mann went to his student Coleman, who was supposed to be some bit of a math nerd, and said, have you heard about SU3? So Coleman apparently blew up. He told this guy, look, I may be a math nerd, but I don't deal in weird things like SU3. So Gell-Mann must have read about it himself, and he wrote down SU3 in terms of, you know, Gell-Mann matrices, the SU3 algebra in terms of Gell-Mann matrices in this paper. Okay, and Amol did some number crunching and found that this is Gell-Mann's highest cited paper, but highest cited because of the Gell-Mann matrices. Then it is another paper which you'll talk about. Yeah, okay. Not the highest cited paper, but okay. So he says that he does all kinds of things. Then in the last section he says, let's sit back and look at what we have done. What we have done is we have introduced a three-dimensional representations of particle B. B, of course, now we know for baryons, okay, which belongs to a representation of this group, which he calls 3. Antiparticles B bar belong to a different representation, 3 star. Okay, he makes the point, 3 star means it's not the same as 3, blah, blah, blah. Okay, mesons are formed by pairs B bar B and belong to the representation given by absolutely modern language, 3 cross 3 star, which can be decomposed into an octet of mesons and a singlet of mesons. Okay, absolutely modern language, this is where it originates, in the language that we still continue to use. Okay, then he says something about how baryons remain a problem, because to make baryons you have to have a baryon, baryon, anti-baryon, which means you have to have a 3 cross 3 cross 3 star, which would give something which doesn't quite agree with what's going on. Okay. Now, as I said, when I was a first year student, okay, one of the stories that we heard was there was this school where Gell-Mann came, TIFR Winter School, held in Bangalore, where Gell-Mann came and he talked about eightfold way. Okay, so I checked back with Rajshekaran, who was at this school. And Rajshekhan says, yes, indeed, he came. He talked about this eightfold way. And then he actually said that, you know, these eight baryons should be fitted into an octet. Okay. And Dalits was sitting in the audience. And Dalits says, that doesn't work because you had a triplet of baryons already. Where is that triplet? Okay. And Gelman had no answer. So that was in 1961. So when the paper was written in 1962, maybe Gelman had this in mind, could be, that you can't really talk about baryons. So he doesn't talk really about baryons in this paper. Okay, he knows there's a problem. But he does acknowledge Neyman's work, which gets the eightfold way, okay, out of these representations. And the eightfold way, I am told, again, I got this from people who were associated with Gelman at that time, that the name Eightfold Way was due to Gelman's visit to India. Okay, so must have been again the same school. Okay, so anyway, so there was a lot of ferment at that time. Okay, what were the groups involved? Okay, what representations did baryons come in? A lot of work on alternative groups, alternative and the representation theory of alternative groups. Yeah, I found a compendium from 1962. Okay, then it turns out Glashow and Sakurai said, okay, there must be a 27 plate of baryons with spin 3/2. Okay, we take the eightfold way and do something with it, and then we get this 27 plate of baryons, and many of them are not seen, so they must be discovered. Okay, so these are predictions of the eightfold way. Okay, but when they had written these papers, there were a lot of experiments going on in Brookhaven, and you know, some resonances were being found. And these guys looked at some of these papers and immediately jumped on it, changed their stance, and said, no, no, no. What we can do now is we take all the spin 3/2 baryons, and we can put them together into this octet. Into this decaplet. Okay. And they wrote that in a follow-up paper very soon, within months, I think. Okay. And soon after that, the events that they had looked at, people continued to work on them. And Nick Samios and his group in Brookhaven, they at some point found a single heavy baryon with a negative charge. Okay, which they realized through the reaction that they looked at, that this was a strangeness 3 baryon. Okay, and that's exactly what this decuplet would require. Okay, so they wrote a paper based on one single bubble chamber event. Okay, 5 sigma. Okay, so, and in that paper, they refer back to this paper and some conference talk of Gelman. Okay. So, at that point in 1964, this was the periodic table of elements. Okay. So, these blue lines here are strangeness. Okay. This is strangeness 0, strangeness minus 1, strangeness minus 2, strangeness minus 3. There is a singlet, the lambda. There is an octet here. There should be something else. There's a lambda here. What is this? Okay. Should have been more careful. There's something else here. Okay. And there's a decuplet here. Okay. Now, all of these have one isosinglet particle. That's or one isosinglet line passing through this diagram. That's this vertical line here. So you could think of it as a periodic table, with the first period being a singlet, the second period being an octet, the third period being a triplet, and so on. Okay, so periodic table in that sense. Okay. So now phenomenology works, etc., etc. What's going on? Okay. Now, at some point years ago, when I had met Nick Samios, I had asked him, why did you attribute this to Gelman? And he told me that Gell-Mann actually gave a talk in CERN sometime in 1962, where he said there must be, you know, there's this thing which is almost a decuplet, but something is missing, and that would be a strangeness 3 particle negatively charged. Okay, and that's this thing. So, and he had already talked about quarks and so on in private conversation. It never been written down. And I've heard stories, I can't verify them, that he had tried to send one of these papers to a journal, but the journal refused, saying, you know, very speculative. Okay. Okay. So nothing was written down until 1964. Okay. This is at the time that Nixamius found that one event. Okay. And in this paper, he talks first a couple of paragraphs about Sakata model and so on. And he says there's also an alternative, that the triplet that we need is not baryon number 1, but has baryon number 1/3. Okay. Then the mesons are made up of this triplet, Q bar Q. So you'll get back the eightfold way. Okay. But the baryons are made of 3 quarks, so that you get 3 cross 3 cross 3, 1 plus 8 plus 10. Then he continues, okay. It is fun to speculate about the way quarks would behave if they were physical particles of finite mass instead of purely mathematical entities, as they would be in the limit of infinite mass. Okay, and he says, okay, what would happen is that everything would decay, all the quarks would decay into each other, and there would be a lightest quark, and that quark cannot decay into something else, so you would then find it. And so, and he suggested this interesting thing that, you know, there must be quarks out there, if there are these quarks somewhere in space, and you know, they would decay and eventually they would come fall down to Earth, so the Earth's crust must be full of fractionally charged particles, if this is true. Okay. Now, so that's an interesting thing, because he suggests something and then suggests that you look for it. He acknowledges here a discussion with Serber. He says he visited, in 1962, he visited Columbia. He had a discussion with Serber, and he attributes the idea as coming out of that discussion. He doesn't attribute it to Serber, but attributes it to that discussion. That's the only time Serber appears in this story. And of course, famously, he ascribes the word quark to James Joyce, Finnegan's Wake. Okay. Well, 5 years later, he got the Nobel Prize. And I think it's important to remember that he was really terribly young at the time that he got the Nobel Prize. He was born in 1929. Okay. And his Nobel Prize was given for his contributions and discoveries concerning the classification of elementary particles and their interactions. The Nobel Prize is often the end of a person's career. Okay. This man was really young at that time, and it didn't end his career. Okay. This is tremendous. Okay. But he actually went on to invent, within years, a huge part of the standard model. Okay. Quantum chromodynamics. In 1972, in a talk, Fritsch and Gell-Mann introduced a new quantum number for quarks, which they call color. Okay. And they said that quarks should come in 3 kinds of colors. So there's a triplet of color. Okay. And the reason they hypothesized this in the paper, in the talk, they say you need it to get the correct amplitude for pi naught decay. Okay. Then they go on to say all baryon states are colorless. Okay. Color and fractional electric charge is never seen in experiments. Okay. Right at the time that color was introduced, color was also introduced as a confined quantum number. Okay. And this is a completely different theory, notion of what is elementary. Up till now, we thought about element in terms of scalpels and cutting things out. Okay. And exhibiting pieces that you cut out. But here was a new notion of physical reality, of elements, in which things could not be cut out and displayed. Okay. In the same paper, they say you can add a color octet of vector bosons, which they call gluons, already in 72. And they said you can make a Yang-Mills theory of interacting quarks and gluons. And they went on to discuss in this conference the kinds of observations that the theory of this kind will support. A year later, Fritsch, Gell-Mann, Leutweiler went on to write a more detailed paper, but detailed, you know, still a physics lattice, okay, where they state very clearly, infrared, and I quote, infrared divergences could provide a mechanism for confining all color non-singlets permanently. When I was a postdoc, I would hear all Germans say infrared divergences. I would say, but that's wrong. And we would have arguments. But it comes from here. So they actually make this statement, which we believe today, which we cannot prove, nobody can prove. If you manage to prove it, you get $1 million. It's one of the Clay Millennium Prizes. Okay. In this paper, they also give reasons for using octet gluons. Okay. And these reasons are important because I think already in 1969, when this Nobel Prize was given, at that time, the first deep inelastic scattering. Okay. Scatterings of electrons from protons with a large change in momentum, large space-like change in momentum, were observed, and they could be interpreted in terms of point-like structures inside the proton. Okay. And these people say how some Yang-Mills theory of interacting quarks and gluons, quantum chromodynamics, could possibly give rise to such point-like structures, and they used a hand-waving argument based on a renormalization group, what we today call renormalization group equations of Gell-Mann and Loeb. Okay. Of course, the full story of this would take years, not too many years, but a few more years still, but it's all here. Okay. So one part of the standard model was written down by 1973 in a recognizably modern form. I'll stop here. Came later. Yeah, so that's part of this. That's part of this argument. Okay, that RG will somehow get that. Yes, but it had to be demonstrated. It had to be demonstrated.
A glimpse of Gell-Mann's work on weak interaction. It will be sort of in the basically try to give a history of weak interactions, and Gell-Mann's work that appears there will be portrayed specially. Yeah, so this is Gell-Mann, of course, and this is weak interaction. Okay. So Arundhva, 200 years back, I can go back a few million years, maybe 100,000 years, why not? So weak interactions around us actually happen to be at places from where we don't even realize it. So for example, mankind has seen weak interactions since about 100,000 years, the main being the sun, because nuclear fusion that take place inside the sun involve weak interactions, and in fact therefore I can claim to go much farther back than Schrödinger. So, however, the modern weak interaction that we saw mainly were nuclear beta decays, which we started seeing in the initial years of the 20th century. And then, of course, when we started looking at cosmic rays, the cosmic ray experiments gave you muons, pions, and kaons, and we saw their decays, many of them were actually weak decays. also what is called as modern parlance, weak decays in particle physics, I would say actually started from nuclear beta decays as well as decays in the cosmic rays. So now let's come to the stage where Shivarendu started with in the early 1950s, and from this point we will diverge. So what was the state of art in 1950s? We knew that there were nucleons, protons and neutrons. It was known that they are related by what is called isospin symmetry. We have also seen charged and neutral pions, which were also related by isospin symmetry. And it was known that isospin is conserved in strong interactions, which happen very fast, but violated in electromagnetic interactions, which have slightly slower rates. So it was expected that all the particles that we have would either be somehow related by isospin to neutrons and protons if they are fermions, and they would be related to pions if they are bosons. So now cosmic rays give us many particles which have some strange properties. At that point they were called as V1 plus, V1 minus, V1 0, V4, tau plus, tau minus. In the modern language we know them as sigma plus, sigma minus, sigma 0, lambda, k plus and k minus. So what was observed is that when these particles were produced, they were produced in pairs. This is what was later called an associated production. You never see a single strange particle, you always see two at a time. And you of course expect these particles, which are heavier than nucleons, to decay immediately by strong interactions to protons and neutrons. It was not observed so. The lifetimes of these were actually quite long, because strong interactions happen very quickly, whereas lifetime of these particles were of the order of 10 power minus 8 seconds or so, so which were quite long. So the question is, if they were just isospin partners of nucleus and pions, why is it that these particles don't just quickly decay by strong interactions into nucleons and pions? People had proposals indicating why it would happen. Peasley, for example, gave a proposal that these particles V1 may have isospin phi halves, so it's a large isospin, okay, and therefore by isospin conservation, strong interactions will not be able to decay V1 into a proton. But of course, this was not complete, because there were electromagnetic interactions. Electromagnetic interactions violate isospin, and therefore this does not work, because electromagnetic interactions will be able to take these particles quite quickly into protons and neutrons. So that's the reason that the first proposal by Peasley did not work. Pais gave the next proposal, which said that new particles are extra orbital, well actually said orbital isotopic angular momentum, not exactly isospin, but they also have negative isotopic parity, and which sort of meant that since electromagnetic interactions do not violate isotopic parity, you will also forbid electromagnetic decays to protons and neutrons. Okay, so this went sort of one more step further. This is where a 1953 paper of Gell-Mann came into picture, in which he gave the following proposal. He tried to decouple spin and isospin. Somehow the thinking was that fermions have half integral spin, so must have half integral isospin, bosons have integral spin, so therefore must have integral isospin. This paper decouples them. He actually proposes that the fermions, which are the lambda and sigma particles, should have integral isospin, whereas the bosons will have half integral isospin, since a priori they are not related at all. And this solved many of the problems. So firstly, because the isospin was integral, and the electromagnetic transitions cannot give you change in isospin equal to half or 3/2, it specifically meant that electromagnetic transitions will not be able to take these particles into neutrons and protons. So that problem was solved. Of course, production also had to be associated because of this strangeness. However, this paper proposed one more test of this mechanism, which is that now that they have integral isospins, turns out that two nucleons going to V plus V is not possible. They mentioned that it is possible to have V plus V bar. Okay, so it is not just associated production, but also the fact that somehow V plus V is possible and V plus V bar is not possible. It does relate to the idea of strangeness at the back of their mind, But as Shaurendu said, this didn't come into fore for at least the next couple of years. So this prediction of theirs, they gave a list of interactions which are possible and lists which are not possible, were confirmed in the next couple of years, and that actually confirmed the fact that whatever Gell-Mann proposal here was actually corresponded to the isospins of these particles. Okay, so this was in 53. In 1955, this was the paper that Shaurendu also mentioned. By the time we also had discovered particles which were spin 0 but neutral, called theta 0. It was not sure what they were, in fact they were also called as tau zeros, because some of them happened to decay to 2 pions and some of them happened to decay to 3 pions. I think decay to 2 pions were called as the taus and 3 pions were called as theta, or vice versa. This part I am not very sure about. No, sorry, theta, the 2 pions were theta and 3 pions were tau. Now they gave an argument in this paper which said that of course theta theta bar will not mix, because associated production tells you that you cannot have theta and theta bar don't have the same stageness. However, since there is a theta 0, there also must be an antiparticle called theta bar 0. Okay. Since the decay of theta naught to pi plus pi minus does happen by the so called weak interactions, which break certain symmetries, the same symmetry breaking will also allow theta naught bar to go to pi plus pi minus, and therefore through this extra weak interaction there will be a mixing between theta 0 and theta 0 bar. Okay. The two particles therefore are theta 0 plus theta 0 bar and theta 0 minus theta 0 bar, which are theta 1 0 and theta 2 0, and one of them would decay to 2 pions, 1 to 3 pions. This was the solution of this so called tau theta puzzle, because these two particles should have different lifetimes. Here of course you see kk bar, and that is because these thetas are what we now call as kaons. So if you want to read through the argument again, the argument basically says that since you have k, you should also have k bar. K goes to pi pi, k bar goes to pi pi, therefore actual state should be k plus k bar and k minus k bar. Okay. One of them will have a very large lifetime, one of them will have a small lifetime. Okay. So in the language of that times, this was noticed by Gell-Mann and Pais in about 1955. In parallel, people were trying to look at the nature of weak interactions, explore what it looks like. One major development was of course the discovery of parity violation. So in 1956, Li and Yang proposed that there could be parity violation. They propose certain experiments, for example, the angular distribution of positrons in cobalt 60 decays. It was performed by Madame Wu, who found evidence for parity violation. Around the same time, Garmin, Lederman, Weinrich also performed experiment on decay of pions to muons to electrons and confirmed that indeed parity is violated. So this gave an impetus to the search for Lorentz structures of weak interactions that can explain the data, because of course people knew that we have to have Lorentz invariance, and therefore since we did not know anything about intermediate particles, people were trying to look for currents with certain Lorentz structures, so that current-current interactions would be able to give you your Lagrangians. At the same time, Li and Yang were the ones who proposed that we could explain all the data by a combination of scalar operators and tensor operators, which meant that a current is a scalar current or a tensor current. Turns out that this proposal failed because of many other observations. The proposal which actually came very close to explaining everything was the proposal by Sudarshan and Marshak. It happened in 1957-58, which they called as V minus A interaction. Okay, which specifically meant that the current was a V minus A current or gamma mu times 1 minus gamma phi current. It explained many things but did not explain a few. For example, it could explain all beta decay experiments. It explained neutron decay, oxygen 14 decay, which was the most precisely measured decay at that time, allowed decays, forbidden decays, parity conserving decays, non-conserving decays, everything, except there was a decay of helium 6 and there was a correlation between electrons and neutrino that was coming from helium 6 decay, which was not explained by V minus A. From polarized neutron decay, there should not be electron asymmetry, whereas an experiment had actually shown that there could be one. Therefore, this was not explained by Sudarshan Mashak proposal. All muon decays and decay rates could be explained, except there was one experiment in Colombia which measured the polarization of positron from muon decay, and V minus A could not satisfy that. It explained all pion decays except the fact that pion should decay to electron and neutrino. It was not observed to the level that was expected, and it explained all decays of strange particles except decays of this particle called as chi or cascade. So, of course, so therefore, there are positive and negative things about V minus A interactions as proposed by Sudarshan and Mashak. There is of course a lot of controversy about it was it's very clear that Sudarshan and Mashak actually had talked to Gell-Mann and Feynman before they went and wrote their paper. Let us not get into that. Let me talk about the physics of the paper that Gell-Mann and Feynman did.
Did they talk to Gell-Mann, not to Feynman? Feynman was in
South. Oh, sorry, to Gell-Mann, not to Feynman. First thing that they did is they were very brave and just said that experiments that do not correspond to V minus A are wrong. Okay. So, this paper explicitly says that some experiments like helium 6, this is I am quoting them, must be wrong. Whereas, the other part which is the pion to electron decay may have a certain resolution. Turned out that this sort of confident jump actually was true. All the experiments that I listed in the previous page which did not correspond to V minus A actually turned out to be wrong. Okay, actually, okay. So what Sudarshan and Mashak had thought was theory was actually true. Feynman and Gell-Mann publicized this theory as is said in some articles. However, so this article of Feynman and Gell-Mann essentially made the following points. It was thought that maybe the parity violation, because it was earlier only observed in decays where neutrinos are involved, these people showed that parity violation could happen even in processes that do not have neutrinos, okay, which means that parity violation source is not neutrinos. On the other hand, there is something fundamental about weak interactions, and that source gives rise to both of these phenomena, the phenomena of parity violation and the phenomena that neutrinos are only left handed have their origin in something else, which of course we later on find to be the standard model of particle physics. They also proposed a test which did not involve neutrinos. So, they said that if you have any experiment which indicates that the electron is not 100% left polarized as its velocity goes to speed of light, then this theory will not be proved to be true. Another test that they gave was the following. At that point of time, if you look at the data, V minus A and V plus A were equally probable. However, they could be distinguished by looking at the angular asymmetry of neutron decay, which would be 0 for V minus A and maximal for V plus A. That is something that these two people proposed. And when the asymmetry was actually measured to a good precision, it was found to be corresponding to V minus A. This is a footnote 5 of this paper, which says the following. It says the universal V comma A interaction has also been proposed by E.C. Sudarshan and R.E. Mashak to be published, which definitely indicates that they knew that this work was going on. Just one thing I noticed that they do not say V minus A here, although Sudarshan Mashak paper says V minus A, they somehow only say V comma A interactions. We are going ahead 1 or 2 years at a time. Around 1960, Gell-Mann and Levy noticed that the Fermi constant for muon decay and the Fermi constant for neutron decay are very similar. However, there was some slight difference. Okay. So, they claim that maybe this is universality and they are the same. However, if they are different, we just propose something. Okay. So, in fact, they proposed this not in the original paper, but it was in a footnote added in proofs. So, in fact, the footnote actually says this was added later in proofs. They say, okay, fine. So, we propose that if this difference is real, it may be explained by the following. So, in fact, the vector current corresponding to strangeness conserving part and strangeness violating part, delta s equal to 0 and delta s equal to 1, can be given by these two terms. Now, here you notice this is p bar, which means a proton. This is neutron, this is lambda. So, this says that the coupling between protons and neutrons is proportional to 1 divided by root of 1 plus epsilon square. The coupling between lambda and protons is epsilon divided by root of 1 plus epsilon square. And now, if you by hindsight, if you think about it, it looks like you are saying there is a mixing, because these two quantities are just same as sine theta and cosine theta. In fact, this was the seed of Kabibbo angle, which Kabibbo proposed in 1961, I think. And in fact, Kabibbo acknowledges the work of Gell-Mann and Levy and says that this is the equation that actually gave him the idea of proposing that there is actually a mixing between quarks. Lots of things were happening in 1960s, and Shorenyu talked about all of these. This I found very amusing, that ordinary matter from Earth's surface may be contaminated by stable quarks from cosmic rays. Okay. However, I will not talk about this, because this is mainly strong interactions. However, in 60s, lots of things were also happening in weak interactions. So, what we had at that time, what we can call a standard model, had basically two generations. You knew about up, down, charm and strange quark. We knew about electron and muon. In 1966, I think, even the two species of neutrinos were known. Charm was not, I should have taken about charm. But the two species of electrons were known in the 1966 experiment by Steinberger et al. At this point of time came what we now call as the standard model of weak interactions of particle physics, which was in these three papers, Glashow, Weinberg and Salam. Papers, as you see, are distributed in time, simply because at that point of time when the papers came out, it was not clear that this theory actually worked. Okay. It is only later on when the experiment showed that the predictions of these were verified, that one calls that as Glashow, Weinberg, Salam theory. However, seeds of this are in in very different papers. So, what is this theory? So, all particle physicists here would already know. They identified that the gauge group of electroweak interactions is SU2 cross U1. However, only left handed quarks or leptons are charged under SU2 symmetry, and therefore, nowadays we call it as a group which is SU2L cross U1. Okay. In other words, in modern language, W couples only to left handed quarks and leptons. Right handed quarks are singlets, and parity violation is therefore exists even with massless quarks, because properties of left handed quarks and right handed quarks are different, their quantum numbers are actually different. So, in the foundational quantum numbers of quarks and leptons itself, we already have parity violation built in. Masses of quarks, leptons and gauge bosons are given through Higgs mechanism. Okay, so, that is a standard model of particle physics with two generations. However, things soon changed when 1960s passed. Okay, this is in fact what we saw now. So, you can see which are the missing items. Okay, and I guess this C should also have been missing in this case. So, 1970s, Kobayashi and Maskawa came and showed that since we observe charge parity violation, it can happen only if you have three quark generations, okay, and that was in 1972. So, people expected that there would be discovery of the third generation of quarks and leptons very soon. It had not happened yet at this stage. However, there were E plus E minus experiments around center mass energy of between 3 and 5 GeV, okay, and they only indicated that there could be some higher resonances. Okay. At this point, they had not shown any higher resonances. That was the time when a paper came of Fritz, Gell-Mann and Minkowski, which was the first paper which gave you a theory of 6 quark flavors, 6 lepton flavors and SU2 cross U1 gauge symmetry. However, this is not the correct symmetry as we know now. They did not a SU2L. This was a different theory. They said that the weak currents are actually vector like, which means that whatever interactions are there for left handed quarks are also for right handed quarks, which now we know is not true. Their idea was that the parity violation does not come from assignment of quantum numbers to quarks and leptons, but it actually comes from fermion masses, and they say, well, this will come from connection to Higgs and so on and so forth. Okay. So, this theory actually, although it which was named as vector like weak currents and new elementary fermions, at that time was somehow worked. However, later experiment showed that finally this is not going to work. Okay. This is 1975. As Chaurindu said, some of the very famous work of Gell-Mann was done even after he got Nobel Prize. So, this is now 1979. This happens to be the paper which is most cited. However, citations for this are 2900 and the other is 2860. Okay. So, it is that is the eightfold wave paper. So, what was Gell-Mann doing at this point of time? People were talking about what happens beyond weak interactions. Because in the standard model, as we saw here, okay, perhaps in the interactions, quarks, I should have said charged leptons and gauge bosons get a mass to Higgs interaction. Neutrinos still had not got a mass. Okay. And the reason for that was because with this standard model, there were no right-handed neutrinos. Okay. As a result, you could not write down a Dirac mass term for neutrinos. So, therefore, they could not have a mass. However, people anyway were looking for gauge unification, which means that there could have been larger gauge groups, people looking at SU5, SO10, E6, blah, 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 such that at some point of time, this symmetry will break because of maybe some extra Higgses and their vacuum expression values, so that you reduce down to SU3 plus SU2 plus U1. Now, these larger gauge groups had space for right-handed neutrinos and therefore, you could give neutrinos a mass. Okay. These people, Gell-Mann, Ramon and Slansky in 1979 said that if you have SO10 unification, then in that you have right-handed neutrinos. Those neutrinos have Majorana mass. The normal loop neutrinos which are left handed get Dirac mass by combining with them. But as a result, finally, the mass of the observed neutrino which you see in your laboratory will be Dirac square divided by Majorana. Okay. This is what we now call as seesaw mechanism, because higher the Majorana mass, lower the mass of neutrino. And this actually turns out to be a useful concept, simply because we know that mass of neutrinos that we observe is much lighter than the masses of all the quarks and leptons. It is more than million times lighter than an electron, as we know. And the smallness of this mass now gets connected to the largeness of Majorana mass of right-handed neutrinos. Okay. And of course, we know that right-handed neutrino mass is not protected by any symmetry of standard model, and therefore, it can have as large a mass as you want. So, you can actually therefore, by looking at neutrino masses, probe the mass scales which are of the order of 10 to the power 12 GeV also. Okay. And this is the seesaw mechanism. So, this happens to be one of the first ideas where seesaw mechanism comes without calling it seesaw. Minkowski a few years back had also mentioned this. However, Yanagira, Mahopatra, Sanjanovich and Schlechter Valle in 1980. Were the ones who actually gave concrete models for generating these kinds of neutrino masses. So, this basically was the travel of the contribution of Gell-Mann from about 1953 to 1979 on issues connected with weak interactions as well as some things beyond weak interactions. Okay. So, I do not know what he is pointing at, but let me now point at Probeer. I think you should be the next one.
You done it.
No, no, no.
I have it in my pen drive. I thought you already have put it in. So up and down, right? Well, thank you for asking me to give this talk. When I prepared this talk, I was not aware that Soranzu and Amol are going to cover parts of Gell-Mann's work. So there will be some overlap with them, but that should be okay. Gell-Mann was a multifaceted personality, and I had the pleasure of knowing him at a personal level. In 1971-72, I was, let's see, how does this yeah. Here? Opposite. Or the other way? Right and left back, right? So, in 1971-72, I was a postdoc at CERN, and Gell-Mann was also at CERN spending his sabbatical, and we had neighboring offices. And Gell-Mann's postdoc, Harald Fritsch, was a friend of mine. And we discussed many times, and we had lunch together several times informally. So I got to know him quite a little bit. And, you know, he was a polymath. I'll describe some aspects of his personality in just a moment. he was born, of Jewish parents, immigrants, from Ukraine in 1929 in Manhattan, and he told me that the original name of his family was Hellman. Now, Hellman in the Cyrillic script, the H is gamma, you know, gamma as. Now, gamma, this letter in the Cyrillic script, both Ukrainian. Ukrainian, but G in Russian. And at some point, the name got Russified and got changed from Hellman to Gell-Mann. That's how the name Gell-Mann came. Gell-Mann had tremendous interest and knowledge of languages and the origin of languages. In fact, he was very unhappy that the charged quantum of weak interactions was called the W boson. His favorite name for it was the X boson. He always, in his papers, he will always write X boson, and his collaborators would put W within brackets. Because, you see, he had a deep knowledge of the Mayan language. And in the Mayan language, there's a word called ux. And ux means soul. And he believed that the charged soul of the weak interaction, so it should be called the X boson. See, he had that kind of knowledge. And you know, I met him and I introduced myself, and he said, ah, but your Bengali name is Rai, right? And it's been anglicized to Roy. I was astounded. Many of my Indian friends don't know this. And so I remarked that, look, you seem to know a lot about Bengali names. Then he told me a story. See, Feynman was giving a seminar at Caltech, and he mentioned Bose statistics. And Gell-Mann stood up and said, no, it's not Bose statistics. The original Bengali name is Bosu, and it can be translated into either Basu or Bose. And the gentleman concerned wrote his name as S.N. Bose. You should say Bose statistics. See, this is the kind of knowledge. He was introduced once to the physicist Roman Jakif, and immediately he told Jakif that you don't know how to pronounce your own name. Gasket. And Gell-Mann said, it's the Polish Jaskib. And you are mispronouncing. And then, you know, he was part of the Jason committee, and in that capacity he had to deal with administrators in the US administration, and there was a secretary in the Nixon administration called Henry Pipes. And he introduced himself, I'm Henry Pipes. He must say, you're mispronouncing your name. It's the Hungarian Pipes. The kind of knowledge he had about people's names and the origin of words and so on. Okay, so let me go to the next topic. As I said, he was a polymath. He had multifarious interests, varied interests, particle physics, evolution of language. I have already mentioned that it will be archaeology, natural history, complex adaptive system, biocultural evolution of mankind, and the process of learning. So I can't cover all that in just an hour's talk. So I'll cover particle physics, I'll talk a little bit about evolution of language, and perhaps mention his interest in complex adaptive systems. Now, he was educated in the Columbia Grammar and Preparatory School and did his undergraduate at Yale and his PhD in 3 years at MIT, and his supervisor was Victor Weisskopf. So he had a fairly distinguished background, and he was a postdoc at Princeton, 51-52, and then he was an assistant professor at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and then became an associate professor at Chicago University, 54-55, and at the age of only 26, he became the Robert Andrews Millikan Professor at Caltech, which he continued till 93. He had co-founded the Santa Fe Institute and was a distinguished fellow there, and was there till his death, 1984-2018. And he was also a director of John D. Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. He, of course, received many honors, Danny Heinemann Prize in Mathematical Physics, Ernesto Lawrence Memorial Award, Nobel Prize in 69, Ettore Majorana Science for Peace Prize in 89, Albert Einstein Medal 2005, Fellow and Foreign Fellow of numerous National Academy Society, Royal Society, Fellow of the IFR, and so on. Now, clearly a very, very multifaceted personality and a wide span of research interest and contribution in politics. So let me quickly mention a few. Now, in 1952-53, when he was a postdoc, he was working with Goldberger, Kroll, and Lowe on dispersion theory. See, you have in particle physics at high energies, two particles colliding, let's say, and going into two other particles, or the same particles. And they have momenta like P and Q. And P plus Q must be equal P prime plus. These are four momenta, relativistically. And that's momentum, four momentum conservation. Now, these are real objects, P and Q, but one can make, fictitiously make them complex. And then one has a complex P plane and the complex Q plane, and one can use properties of them in the complex plane, like analyticity and so forth, and then correlate different scattering amplitudes, different cross sections. And they did a lot of that using techniques of complex variable theory, complex analysis like dispersion relations and so forth. So that was done in 52-53. 54, he produced a really an outstanding piece of work with Lowe. And this is the renormalization group. I'll not go into the details, but give you very simply. See, in field theory, quantum field theory, you have vertices. Like in electrodynamics, the basic vertex is electron photon, okay? And similarly, other vertices. Now, these are point-like in the basic description of the field theory in terms of a Lagrangian. But because of quantum effects, because of quantum loop effects, they become not constants, but functions of some kind of energy scale, which is mu, let's say, which is a mass variable, some sort of energy scale variable. So the coupling strength G becomes a function of this mass scale, mu. And Gell-Mann and Lowe did it in a somewhat more complicated way. In modern notation, you get an equation called renormalization group equation, and that's the variation of mu of this G function, and that's given by a function of G called the beta function. And this can be right-hand side, can be calculated in order by order in perturbation theory. And the source The later work by Callan and Szymanczyk, of course, simplified these things at Hooft, but the basic idea originates in the work of Gell-Mann and Loeb. So that was his first really distinguished contribution. Then, of course, people have already, both Sorendu and Amol have talked about the Gell-Mann-Nishijima formula. So there were these cosmic ray particles which had been seen, bosons K plus, K minus, K0, K0 bar, hyperons sigma plus, sigma 0, sigma minus, and lambda. And of course, Gell-Mann and Nishijima independently proposed this formula. Charge is given by isospin times half times V plus S. And this was later called the hypercharge, Y. So you see, for example, take sigma plus, the hyperon with positive charge, and strangeness minus 1. Sorry, strangeness 1. So you get Q is 1, I3 is 1. So you get B is 1, 1 minus 1. S should be minus 1. I made a mistake here. And then that works. And similarly for the K mesons. And now we'll come to the quark model in a moment. There is a thing called the U quark, which is one of the basic constituents. There are three quarks in a proton. So the U quark, for example, has a baryon number of a third. Charge is two-thirds. Isospin is half because U quark, there is a down quark. They make an isodoublet, so it's isospin. Three is half. So again, strangeness is zero. Again, the formula works. So you see, Gell-Mann had this intuition, qualitative intuition, of sort of guessing correctly the pattern of symmetry. See, symmetry you can describe mathematically in terms of Lie groups, transformations, representations, and so forth. But you have to guess the correct pattern. And Gell-Mann had this uncanny intuitive ability of guessing the right pattern, seeing a set of data, seeing a set of various phenomenological quantities, he is able to guess correctly the right inside pattern. That was his intuitive strength. Now we come to weak interactions, which have already been talked about by Amol, which are responsible for radioactivity and stellar reactions that cause stars to shine. Fermi had this theory that weak interaction was really a product of two currents, like the electromagnetic current. I haven't given the indices, Lorentz indices, and so forth. The electromagnetic current is between half field and its conjugate, with a gamma matrix in between, and it was like a vector current, like electromagnetic current, but changing the charge. So it can go take a neutron to a proton, for example. But it can't be just a vector current. You see, it was shown that there is this beta decay. Boron 12 goes to carbon 12 and electron and antineutrino, and both boron 12 and carbon 12 were known to be nuclei with spin 1. So a vector current, it turns out by quantum mechanics, cannot take a spin 1 object to a spin 1 object. And you need then axial or tensor or other things. So people started looking at generalities, that you can have pseudoscalar, scalar, axial vector, tensor, everything. Now Sudarshan and Marshak had this beautiful idea. Sudarshan actually had the idea. He went to Marshak. Sudarshan was a graduate student at Rochester. He went to Marshak and told Marshak, oh yes, that's beautiful, we'll write it up. So Sudarshan said that, you know, all this myriad of interactions, scalar, pseudoscalar, tensor, vector, axial vector, let me use a symmetry. He assumed that the electron field or the neutrino field were invariant under a symmetry involving the exponent of I alpha gamma 5. Gamma 5 is one of the Dirac matrix. That immediately tells you the current has to be V minus A. So that was their proposal. They wrote a very short paper and proposing this and saying that the weak interaction current has to be of the form vector minus axial vector. So Marshak, I had a long discussion with George Sudarshan. So Marshak said, look, I'm going to this conference in Padua, Venice. This is 75 I'm talking about, mid 75. Let me present this there and then we'll publish it. So Marshak goes to this conference and presents it, and then somebody in the audience says, there's an experiment by Ruby and Rustad in helium 6 beta decay that disagrees with your theory. And then Marshall was pretty, you know, scared. And he came back to Rochester and told George that, look, this seems to be disagreeing, so let's not publish it. Let's wait and see how it pans out. So this was 1975. 57. Now, in 58, then Feynman and Gell-Mann proposed V minus A theory in a physical review paper published in 58. Sudarshan and Marshak paper not published yet. Then they, of course, they had more content. I mean, they got it from a different, I don't know how Gell-Mann did it, because it's well known that Sudarshan and Marshak had discussed it with Gell-Mann, but Feynman had a completely different way of approaching the V minus A theory. He was working with massless neutrinos, and massless neutrinos can obey the something called the Wilde equation instead of the Dirac equation. And that has this invariance, neutrino goes to half 1 minus gamma 5 neutrino. And under that, if you demand that invariance, you get the V minus A structure. So they got it from a different way, and they had a footnote, as was pointed out by both Sorandu and Amul, that such a similar thing was proposed by Sudarshan and Marshak. Now, it was disagreeing with this experiment of Gustav and Ruby, which favored pseudoscalar and tensor currents and so on. So there was the 7th Rochester Conference in 1958. Gell-Mann was giving this talk, and somebody from the audience said, but you are disagreeing with Gustav and Ruby, this V minus A theory. And Gell-Mann in public said, look, this theory is so beautiful, the experiment got to be wrong. The experiment has to be repeated, and we'll see what happens then. And indeed, the experiment was repeated, and Rustad and Ruby were proved wrong, and the later experimental results established the V minus A theory. So Feynman and Gell-Mann, I think it is reasonable to say, unfairly snatched the credit from Sudarshan and Marshak, published their paper later in Novocimento, but 1 year later. So, but then Feynman has acknowledged it publicly. In a conference, he said, V minus theory was proposed by Sudarshan and Marshak, but published by Feynman and Gell-Mann. Okay, now we come to the eightfold way. You know, I'm glad that Sorandu or Amol didn't mention the eightfold way. Gell-Mann had come to India and had visited various Buddhist sites, and then he came to know about Buddha's Ashtamarga. Now you see the Ashtamarga, here's the wheel, Ashtamarga, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right concentration, and right mindfulness. And that's what gave them the idea that the octet of bosons and baryons, as have been already described by Sorandu and Amol, can be called the eightfold way. Now, independently, Yuval Niemann of Israel had also proposed the idea of the octet, although he didn't have the name eightfold way. So this became a classification scheme for mesons, which are spin zero strongly interacting particles, and baryons, spin half atoms. It was also shown to be valid for spin one mesonic resonances and so forth. And groups of octet in the plane of charge and strangeness here. See, these you have already seen. This is the baryon octet and this is the mesonic octet. So you see, this is strangeness on this side, vertical axis, and charge in the horizontal axis. Proton is charged, neutron is chargeless, strangeness zero, both. Now sigma plus, sigma zero, the hyperon, sigma minus, they are isospin one, plus charge, minus charge, and lambda is the isosiglet, the isospin zero, charge zero, and the cascade, zero and minus one, strangeness minus two. And for mesons, we have k0, k plus, k minus, k0 bar, k0 and k0 bar mix, as of course has been explained by Amol, and pi minus, pi 0, pi plus, eta is the singlet, pseudoscalar singlet, eta prime, it turns out to come from the ninth member, nonet, and if you take the U1 group rather than, U3 group rather than the SU3 group, and there is mixing between eta and eta prime, that's why it's shown. Then there were other multiples, as was pointed out, decuplet, which had this omega minus, which is brilliantly explained by Gell-Mann's theory and agreed with the experiment. Now the question was, these are all higher dimensional representations of the group SU3, special unitary matrices, special mean determinant plus one, unitary, U dagger U is one in three dimensions. But then the defining, these matrices are defined in three-dimensional space, and the three the fundamental representation would be triplet, which is a complex representation, and its complex conjugate would be the anti-triplet. Where are those? Initially, as Sorundu pointed out, people had, I mean, Gell-Mann included, had tried to put them in the proton, neutron, lambda, etc. Didn't work. So then Gell-Mann had this idea, and of course it was independently proposed by Zweig, that there could be fractionally charged fermions, which are the constituents of bosons and baryons, and they are the up quark. Initially their names were different, but now settled to up quark, down quark, and strange quark, and this is the triplet. See, in the third component of isospin are hypercharge. Hypercharge, recall, is baryon number plus strangeness. So the up quark is charged 2/3, down quark is charged minus 1/3, there is an isospin half state, a doublet, and the strange quark is charged minus 1/3 and it is an isosinglet. Similarly, the reverse is the mirror image across the horizontal line, say S bar is plus 1/3 and so on, U bar and D bar. So where are these quarks? That question bothered everybody. As was pointed out initially, that people thought that they might exist in rocks, they may have come from cosmic rays, and there were some experimentalists who claimed to have seen them, but they were McCusker in Australia, claimed to have found quark tracks in emulsions. Nobody else found them, and he was laughed out. Then there was a gentleman at Stanford, and he wanted to do Millikan type experiment with plastic balls. And he said, oh, there must be quarks on these plastic balls. And he found one, he claimed. And people said that should be taken to the Washington Museum and kept there because nobody else found it. So these experiments were discarded. Pretty soon it became obvious that quarks, even if they exist, they cannot exist as free particles. They must be confined. Now, remember, we are talking about mid to late 60s. Then there was no concept of color and color SU3 and all these things. So then the experimentalists at Stanford did this experiment, which has already been mentioned. And the experiment was, they had high energy electron beams, GeV scale, which was scattered with large angles called deep inelastic scattering, and the proton or the nucleus, whatever was the target, was excited into a bunch of hadrons, which were left unobserved, summed over. And this, in fact, was shown to prove the existence of quarks confined within the nucleus or within the proton or the neutron. Now, confined in terms, later on we know that they are confined by gluons, and quarks and gluons are, there are three quarks which are fundamental, they are called valence quarks, and there is a sea of quark-antiquark pairs because it's a relativistic system, and there are gluons. Detailed experimental analysis shows that nearly half the content of a proton is gluons, for example. Now, it's a little bit like, you might think, how do you really know there are three quarks? Now, just think. Suppose you have three coins linked by springs inside a plastic ball. And you can, you know, play with that, and you can figure out that there are three coins. In particular, you can see. Now, what is seeing? Light ray comes from some outside source, gets scattered or reflected from the coins and comes to your eye. Now, electrons scattered, instead of photons, the experimentalists use electrons. Electrons scattered from the constituents inside the nucleus, inside the proton or the neutron, and detailed studies with that you could prove that there are three quarks and other things inside the proton. So it was a sort of really a beautiful verification of the quark picture, and the experimentalists also got the Nobel Prize. In fact, Gell-Mann was of course overjoyed when it happened, and eventually it was proved that the constituents inside are quarks and also gluons, and gluons is something that Gell-Mann also played a role in establishing, as I will come to that in a moment. But he was very disappointed that he himself had not thought of it. And if I met him again in CERN in 1980 and after all this, and he said, you know, one of my major disappointments in life is that I didn't think of this way of discovering quarks inside nucleons. So let me now come to quantum chromodynamics. See, what confines the quarks and what are the interactions of the quarks. The quarks interact with vector bosons. This is what was proposed by Fritz Gell-Mann and eventually Fritz Gell-Mann and Leutmüller, that they are called gluons. But you know, if the gluon is like a photon, then it will not confine. Electrons and photons don't confine, for example, together. You don't have confined state of electrons, for instance. So they thought of a new quantum. Actually, this quantum number color was originally thought of by Nambu in a different context. But anyway, they borrowed this idea from Nambu, and they thought that quark would be a color triplet, and antiquark would be a color anti-triplet. And unlike the SU3 quantum numbers that we have talked about already, there's a color SU3 which is exact. And they conjectured that a consequence of an exact non-abelian symmetry like color SU3 is that only singlets can exist in nature. Non-singlets just cannot exist because they will be confined. Non-singlets will have to confine with other non-singlets to make singlets. So the only things that you see like protons, neutrons, pi mesons, k mesons, whatever, are all color singlets. The confinement mechanism comes because, and our colleagues who have been bravely working with lattice quantum chromodynamics have given some, maybe not proved, but given some indication that such a thing might be true. In fact, what happens is that if you take the force between two quarks because of color gluon exchange, at sizable distances, the force should become linear with distance, in which case you will get confinement. Such indications for that have come from the lattice, although I think it's fair to say that they haven't been able to prove it. Anyway, in quantum chromodynamics, which is a theory which was proposed by Fritz, Gell-Mann and Leutmüller in 1973, you have quarks and gluons, but more importantly, you have these gluons interacting with themselves. You see, that is the point. That's the really new thing. So you have a quark-gluon, quark-quark-gluon vortex, like electron-electron-photon vortex in electrodynamics, except that you have some SU3 factors here. But you also have a triple gluon vortex and a quadruple gluon vortex, although this is of higher order. These are the basic vortices of quantum chromodynamics, and it can be shown in perturbation theory using the renormalization group equation that I wrote down earlier, that the beta function, the sign is negative, and that's why Gross, Wilczek and Politzer got the Nobel Prize, showing that this beta function sign is negative, and that shows that the force goes linearly, should go linearly large, and the thing should be called, and also should behave almost freely at short distances. So when they experimentally did these experiments, they found that the constituents were effectively behaving almost freely at very short distances, and that is shown by what is called asymptotic freedom, because this beta function is negative near the origin. So when the couplings are small, and when the couplings are large, the force should become linear. It's a conjecture. Anyway, so the point is that that's really the last great thing. He also did, Gell-Mann also was involved with the seesaw mechanism, but Amol has already talked about it, so I'll not go into that. So the next topic that I would like to talk about is coming to his non-particle physics interests and activities, is complexity. Gell-Mann wrote this book, you know, this book I have here, you're welcome to look at it, I keep it on the table, called The Quark and the Jaguar, and in which he says, I mean, he knew that the quarks were the fundamental units, but he's always wondering how do the fundamental quantities, fundamental entities, get related to complex behavior, to complex systems. He was walking in the jungles of Belize in Central America, and he came face to face with a black jaguar, crouching jaguar. And then the jaguar jumped on, not on him, but on a prey. And he saw that, and he said, that's a very complex adaptive behavior. And he started thinking about how this is related to the fundamental units, the fundamental simplicity of nature. And that was a major occupation and interest. So you see, the simple and the complex. Now he was inspired by this couple of lines from the Chinese American poet Arthur Zay. The world of the quark has everything to do with a jaguar circling in the night. See, we have quark as the fundamental unit, simple. And jaguar as a complex adaptive system. Lots of muscles, lots of veins, lots of currents going, flashing through and so on. Complicated behavior. It's a complicated system. Now, there's a basic unity between simplicity and complexity. See, the simplicity comes from the Greek once folded, and complexity comes from braided together. Now, both fold and braid, fold comes from plik, and braid comes from plex in Greek. And they both, see, Gell-Mann was a real expert on languages, origin, etymology of words, and so on. So, he found out that since Greek, like Roman and Sanskrit, is from some basic Indo-European originating language, that both plik and plex come from the Indo-European word plek. So that's how he perceived some unity between the simple and the complex. Quark is a simple unit of matter. Jaguar is a complex adaptive system avoiding a clear analytical description. How do you relate the two? This was a major preoccupation in the later part of Murray Gell-Mann's life, and the institute at Santa Fe, the major activity there is on that. The research that is still going on at the Santa Fe Institute, which he co-founded, involves the relationship between the elementary and the complex, between basic laws and adaptive behavior. Okay? See, in this book, The Quark and the Jaguar, which I've tried to read, I mean, I haven't understood everything, but whatever I could, he has this diagram trying to explain the interrelation between simple fundamental laws and complex adaptive behavior. So we start with data and what previous knowledge, whatever knowledge we have of previous phenomena. And then as you move up towards complexity, regularities are identified, and that's where fundamental laws come in. And they are put in touch with the data. And then you produce a schema. And you can have various schemata. And this, take one of these schemata, take a schema, and then compare it with the present data involving a complex system. And using that, you try to predict complex behavior, describe and predict complex behavior in the real world, and then you compare its consequences with what is observed, with observation. Now, when you make this comparison, it will turn out that among the various schemata, some of these schemes will be discarded. They will not be able to explain, but some schemes, they may not be the right answers, but at least you buy a process of elimination, you are able to get a subset of schemes which will have a viable selective effect and can try to explain the complex adaptive behavior. That was really his idea. Now here is an example. See, yes?
Schema that you showed before,
yeah,
is exactly what is done from the simple system as well. So what's the difference between the simple and the complex?
Well, you see here you are putting in data. And then you are trying to take a complex system and trying to explain it. Sorry? No, no, simple. Where you have a simple law and it correlates with the data, there is no issue. But now, when you have a very complex system where the correlation with the fundamental laws is not a priori obvious, that's where you use this methodology. That's the only thing I can say. I'm not an expert. See, here's an example. There's a dog jumping to catch a frisbee in its mouth. This is all classical physics. So it's a consequence of Newton's laws. The dog doesn't know about Newton's laws, but it is able to jump and catch the frisbee in its mouth. So this is a complex adaptive behavior. And how do you start from Newton's laws and get? You don't get there from Newton's laws just like that. You have to have a scheme, a schema, and then you try to do that in that way. Another example here, let me give, and this is Gell-Mann's very favorite example, is the jaguar crouching to jump on its prey. Once again, it's a complex phenomenon which you can try to use in this way to relate to some fundamental laws. See, Gell-Mann had applied this kind of analysis. Much of this work that Gell-Mann did was not published, but it was used. Gell-Mann applied this analysis to problems as diverse as deterministic chaos in money markets, a child learning a language, and bacteria developing drug resistance. But what he did publish, along with other co-authors like Hottle and so on, was again application of a similar methodology to some very basic problems in quantum mechanics. For example, the Schrodinger's cat paradox, or the instantaneous collapse of the wave function. And in fact, the many-world interpretation of Gell-Mann and Hottle was based using this kind of an ideology. And these were really his, I'm not really competent to go into detail, please don't ask me questions on those. But you know, this is part of his legacy. I mean, he certainly did work on that. So let me end by saying a final word, which is basically the last sentence of this book. By the way, you're all welcome to leaf through it, anybody who's interested. And it sums up his vision of the most desirable world. A sustainable world is one in which humanity as a whole and the rest of nature operate as a complex adaptive system to a much greater degree than they do now. That's all I have to say. Thank you. No, Wilson is a different issue. That Wilson, Gell-Mann's formulation was simplified by Callan and Simanczyk. I wrote the equation using the Callan-Simanczyk form. Gell-Mann and Lowe had a more complicated way of explaining the same thing. Now, coming to Wilson, with whom I had the pleasure of working as a postdoc, Wilson was applying renormalization group to the idea of scale invariance. See, at various distances, how a system scales, for example, in critical phenomena. He got these indices along with Fisher and Karanoff, using ideas of renormalization group applied to scale invariance. So the unifying feature of Wilson's work was scale invariance independent of distance.
But I think it's basically the same thing.
No, idea, renormalization group is involved, but there are, I mean, it's for nothing that Wilson got the Nobel Prize. He had a new idea, obviously, in scale invariance. No, no, there was something new. There was something very, very new, and no, no, but applying to critical phenomena and getting the critical indices and so on, that's a tremendous achievement.
Okay, we'll take the discussion to some other place. Any other question?
No, I have one thing to say.
Sure.
When you come to complex or large system, there is a saying by Anderson, many is more. In the sense that you can start with fundamental laws, which is few, but when you have a large, you think something large number comes in, it's a new element which enters. And it makes all the difference.
No, so no doubt.
From the elements you cannot always just add it.
No, but you can try to relate. Gell-Mann was seeking the relationship. You're right. You're right. But you are trying to relate the fundamental with the complex. That's all.
Extra input from outside.
Sure.
So I think we'll end by giving some remembrance to today's speaker, as we always have this. Other two also will come up, but the bigger picture for a big man. So this is a very colorful. What is this? Strong and weak. Poor is strong and compass.
I leave the book here for anybody to read. But don't take it away. Someone else's book.
Thank you.